What are you doing? And I don't know what to say. I don't really talk to Justin until after school. He wants me to come over to his house, and I can't. I don't have any excuse. I just know I can't. I have loved his body for so long. I have loved it with devotion, with intensity. If I close my eyes, I can see it better than I see my own, because I have studied it, traced it, detailed it with so much more attention than I have ever spent on myself. It still attracts me. I still feel attachment to it. But it's also just a body. Only a body. If I kiss him now, I will be thinking this. If we have sex now, I will be thinking of this. So I can't. Of course, he asks me why not. Of course, he asks me what else I have to do. I just need to go home, I say. It's not enough. He's pissed. It's one thing for me to say I'm going shopping with Preston or have made plans with Rebecca. It might even be bearable if I said I had homework or wanted to go home and be with my mom. But I'm telling him I'd prefer nothing, and that makes him feel like less than nothing. I understand that and feel bad about it, but I can't. I just can't. The next day, A is only 45 minutes away from me, in the body of a boy. I have a math quiz in the morning, so I can't cut out until lunch. It's not even that I care so much about math, but I realize this could be what my life is becoming, trying to go to as little school as possible to get to wherever A is. And if this is going to be my life, I am going to have to be careful about it. I am not about to flunk out because of a crush or whatever it is. But I'm also not going to stay away any longer than I have to. Since A is being homeschooled today, he has to come up with a plan to escape. I wait for his message and then get it around noon. He's made a dash for the public library, and I should get there as soon as I can. I don't waste any time. As I drive over, I picture him there. Which is strange, because I don't know what he looks like today. Mostly, I'm imagining Nathan from the party. I don't even know why. The library is very, very quiet when I arrive. The librarian asks, "Can I help you?" when I come in, and I tell her that I'm looking for someone. Before she can ask me why I'm not in school, I walk swiftly away from the desk and start to scan the aisles for A. There's a 90-year-old man checking out the psychology section, and a woman who very well might be his wife taking a nap in a comfy chair by an old card catalog. In the kids section, there's a mother nursing. I'm about to give up when I see a row of desks by the window. There's a red-headed boy sitting at one of them, reading a book. He's completely lost in it, not noticing me, until I'm right next to him. I notice that he's cute in an adorable way, and at the same time, I get angry at myself for noticing this. It shouldn't matter. I need to think about A and not care about the body he's in. "Ahem," I say, to lead him back from the world of the book he's reading. "I figured you were the only kid in the building, so it had to be you." I'm expecting a smile, a glint, a relief that I'm finally here. But instead, the boy says, "Excuse me?" He seems supremely annoyed that I've interrupted his reading. It has to be him. I've looked everywhere else. "It's you, right?" I ask. I am not ringing any bells in this boy. "Do I know you?" he asks back. Okay, maybe not. Maybe A's in the men's room. Maybe I'm at the wrong library. Maybe I need to stop walking up to strangers and assuming they're not strangers. "Oh, I'm sorry," I apologize. "I just, am supposed to meet somebody."
"What does he look like?"
Now I'm going to seem like an idiot, because I should know the answer to that question, but I don't. I don't, know, I tell the boy. It's like an online thing.
Shouldn't you be in school?
There's no way this boy is over 18, so I shoot back, shouldn't you be in school?
I can't, he says. There's this really amazing girl I'm supposed to meet.
I've already told myself to start walking away, so it takes a second for me to get what he means. I've been played by the one person I didn't think would play me.
You jerk,
I say.
Sorry, it was just...
No, I will not let him apologize.
You jerky jerk.
I'm going to start walking away. I'm going to go. We've never had rules, but he's broken one anyway. A's standing up now.
Rhiannon, I'm sorry.
He's reaching out, but I don't want it.
You can't do that, I tell him. It's not fair.
He will always know what I look like. I will never know what he looks like.
I will never do it again, I promise.
It's not enough. I can't believe you just did that, I say. Look me in the eyes and say it again, that you promise. He looks me in the eyes. We hold there for a second. Now I can see him, not literally. It's not like there's a little person waving inside his eyes. I just know he's there.
I promise, he says.
He means it. I know he means it. He is in the clear, but I'm not about to let him feel like he's there yet. I believe you, I tell him, but you're still a jerk until you prove otherwise. Neither of us has had lunch yet, so we decide to go eat. A tells me the boy's mother is coming back in 2 hours to pick him up. We don't have much time. We go to the first restaurant we find, a Chinese restaurant that smells like it's just been mopped.
So, how was your morning?
A asks. It was a morning, I tell him. I had a math test. That can't possibly be worth talking about. Steve and Stephanie got into another fight on their way to school. Apparently, Stephanie wanted to stop at Starbucks, and Steve didn't. And because of that, she called him completely self-centered, and he called her a caffeine-addicted bitch. So, yeah. And, of course, Steve then skipped out of first period to get her a venti hazelnut macchiato. It was sweet of him to get her coffee, but passive-aggressive because she really likes caramel macchiatos much more than hazelnut ones. At least she didn't point this out when she thanked him, so everything was back to its shaky normal by the time second period started. That's the big news. I don't tell him that when I saw Justin, he gave me shit for ditching him yesterday, even though it's not like we had plans. He kept telling me he hoped I'd had an amazing night. I told him I had a really amazing time studying math. He acted like he didn't believe me, like I ran off to some party without him. Instead of talking about Justin, I ask A more about the girl he was yesterday. I feel I deserve credit because I ask this as if it's the most natural question in the world. What else did you do when you were a girl yesterday?
It was like being a grenade, A says. Everyone was just waiting for her to go off and do some serious damage. She had power, but it was all cultivated from fear.
I think of Lindsay Craig and her minions. I know so many girls like that. The dangerous ones are the ones who are actually good at it.
I suspect she's very good at it.
I picture A as Lindsay or some other mean girl. Well, I'm glad I didn't have to meet her. Because what would the point be? If A was like that, there's no way we could ever be like this, the way we are now. This might be a cheap Chinese restaurant with grease stains on the menus and ceramic cats guarding the soy sauce on the tables. But it's still an escape. It's still exciting. We hold hands and look at each other, and not much needs to be said. I have found someone who cares about me. And right now, I can accept that. I'm sorry for calling you a jerk, I say. I just...
This is hard enough as it is, and I was so sure I was right.
I was a jerk. I'm taking for granted how normal this all feels.
Justin sometimes does that. Pretends I didn't tell him something I just told him, or makes up this whole story, then laughs when I fall for it. I hate that.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's not like he was the first one. I guess there's something about me that people love to fool. And I'd probably do it, fool people, if it ever occurred to me. I don't want to sound like a complainer. I don't want to sound like this weak girl who can't take care of herself. But I also want him to know I can't stand people being mean, people playing games. I want to guard myself against it, but I make a shitty guard for my own heart. I would rather lose the game than play it. I would rather be hurt than be mean, because I can live with myself if I'm hurt. I don't think I could live with myself if I were mean. I'm worried A is going to try to say something to make it all better, that he's going to tell me it's all in my mind, or even worse, like Justin, he's going to tell me I have to learn how to take a joke, like my lack of humor is the real offense. But A's not saying any of that. Instead, he's emptying the chopstick holder. "What are you doing?" I ask. The woman behind the cash register is giving us a strange look, and I don't blame her. A doesn't answer. Instead, he works the chopsticks into the shape of a heart, covering the table. Then he takes all the sweet and low packets from our table and two others in order to turn the heart a pale paper pink. It's too much, and it's awesome at the same time. When he's done, he points proudly to the heart. He looks like a kindergartner who's just finished a fort.
"This," he says, "is only about 1/90,000,000th of how I feel about you."
I laugh. I think he's forgotten that his heart is full of sweet and low. "I'll try not to take it personally," I tell him. He seems a little offended.
"Take what personally? You should take it very personally."
"The fact that you used artificial sweetener?" Saccharin. Everything fake, but also real. He takes a pink packet from the heart and throws it playfully at me.
"Not everything is a symbol," he shouts.
I am not going to let myself sit undefended. I pull a chopstick from the heart and use it like a sword. He takes up my challenge and raises another chopstick in the same way. He lunges. I parry. We are happy fools. The waiter comes over with some plates. A turns his head, and I pierce his chest.
"I die," A calls out.
"Who has the mushu chicken?"
the waiter asks. "That's his," I say. "And the answer is, yes, we're always like this." After the waiter leaves, A asks me,
"Is that true? Are we always like this?"
"Well, it's a little too early for always," I answer. Not to ruin the moment, just to make sure we're not carried away by it.
"But it's a good sign," he says.
"Always," I tell him. I forget about the rest of my life. I don't even have to push it away. I've forgotten about it. It's no longer there. There is only now. There is only me and A and everything that we're sharing. It doesn't feel like amnesia as much as it feels like a sudden absence of noise. At the end of the meal, we get our fortunes. Mine says, "You have a nice smile." "This isn't a fortune," I say, showing it to A.
"No, you will have a nice smile. That would be a fortune," he tells me.
"Exactly. A fortune has to tell you what's going to happen, not what already is. And really, who doesn't have a nice smile?" "I'm going to send it back," I say. A looks amused.
"Do you often send back fortune cookies?"
"No. This is the first time. I mean, this is a Chinese restaurant.
Malpractice.
Exactly. I wave for the waiter, who comes immediately. My fortune isn't really a fortune. It's just a statement, I tell him. And it's a pretty superficial statement at that. The waiter nods and returns with a handful of cookies, each individually wrapped. I only need one, I tell him. More than one would be cheating. Wait 1 second. I open a second cookie and am relieved by what I find inside. Adventure is around the corner.
Well done, sir,
A says to the waiter once I show it to them both. Your turn, I say. A carefully opens his cookie and practically beams when he reads what the fortune says. What? I ask. He holds it out to me. Adventure is around the corner. I am not a superstitious person, but I'm excited to get to that corner, wherever it may be. I know we don't have much time left. I know that A and I are only borrowing this time from someone else, not receiving it entirely for ourselves. But I want to borrow it for as long as I can. I want him to keep talking to me. I want to keep listening to him. Back in the library, I ask him to tell me more books to read, because I know the answer to this question will get me to know him even more. He shows me the book he was reading before. It's called Feed.
It's about the difference between technological connection and human connection. It's about how we can have so much information that we forget who we are, or at least who we're supposed to be.
He takes me farther down the shelves, to the very end of the YA section, and holds up The Book Thief.
Have you read this?
I shake my head, and he continues.
It's a Holocaust novel, and it's narrated by death itself. Death is separate from everything, but he can't help feeling like he's a part of it all. And when he starts seeing the story of this little girl with a very hard life, he can't look away. He has to know what will happen.
He pulls me back to an earlier shelf.
And on a lighter note, there's this book, Destroy All Cars. It's about how caring about something deeply can also make you hate the world, because the world can be really, really disappointing. But don't worry, it's also funny, too, because that's how you get through all the disappointments, right? You have to find it all funny.
I agree, and I'd talk to him more about that, but he doesn't want to stop. I've asked him the right question, and he wants to answer it fully. He shows me a book called First Day on Earth.
I know this will sound weird, but it's about a boy in a support group for people who feel they were abducted by aliens, and he meets this other guy who may or may not be an alien. But it's really about what it means to be human, and I read it a lot, whenever I find it in a library. Partly because I find new things every time I read it, but also because these books are always there for me. All of them are there for me. My life changes all the time, but books don't change. My reading of them changes. I can bring new things to them each time. But the words are familiar words. The world is a place you've been before, and it welcomes you back.
He shakes his head.
I've never said that to anyone, you know. I've never even said it to myself. But there it is. The truth.
I want to take out all the books, want to start sharing those worlds with him. Then I remember. This isn't my library. This isn't my town.
What about you? A asks. What do you think I should read next?
I know I should show him something really smart and sophisticated, but I know he's asking me the question in the same way I asked him, to see me in the answers, to know more about me after the answers than he did before them. So instead of pretending that Jane Eyre is the story of my life, or that Johnny Tremaine changed me completely when I read it, I lead him over to the kids section. I'm looking for Harold and the Purple Crayon, because when I was a kid, that appealed to me so much. The power to draw your own world, and to draw it in purple. I see it on display at the front of the section and go to get it. As I lean over to pick it up, A surprises me by calling out, "No, not that one!" "What could you possibly have against Harold and the purple crayon?" I ask. "As far as I'm concerned, this is a deal-breaker." A looks relieved.
"I'm sorry," he says. "I thought you were heading for the giving tree."
Who does he think I am? "I absolutely hate the giving tree," I tell him.
"Thank goodness. That would have been the end of us had that been your favorite book."
I would say the same if he'd chosen it. The tree in that book needs to stand up for herself, and the boy needs to be slapped. "Here, take my arms, take my legs," I imitate.
"Take my head, take my shoulders."
"Because that's what love's about." Really, I can't believe parents read the book to children. What an awful message to send.
"That kid is like the jerk of the century," A says.
"The biggest jerk in the history of all literature." It's nice to be agreeing on this point. I put Harold down and move closer to him. I'm not going to need a purple crayon for what's coming next.
"Love means never having to lose your limbs," A tells me, leaning in.
"Exactly," I say, kissing him. "No sacrifice, no pain, no requests. Love. Just love." I am lost in it, enjoyably lost in it. At least until someone yells, "What do you think you're doing?" For a split second, I assume we've been caught by the librarian and are going to be fined. But the woman who's yelling at me isn't the librarian, or anyone else I've seen before. She's an angry, middle-aged woman, spitting out words. Getting all in my face, she says,
"I don't know who your parents are, but I did not raise my son to hang out with whores."
I'm stunned. I haven't done anything to deserve that.
"Mom," A shouts, "leave her alone."
Mom. For a second, I think, this is A's mother. Then I realize, no, it isn't A's mother. A doesn't have a mother, not in the same sense that I have a mother. No, this must be the mother of the boy whose body he's in, the one who homeschools him, the one who let him out to go to the library and has found this.
"Get in the car, George," she orders, "right this minute."
I am expecting A to give in. I will not blame him for giving in, even though I am feeling really attacked. But instead of giving in, A looks George's mother in the eye and says,
"Just calm down."
Now it's George's mother who's stunned. This innocent red-headed boy has probably never spoken to his mom like this before, although I have to imagine there have been plenty of times when she's deserved it. While George's mother is thrown for a moment, A tells me we'll find a way, and he'll talk to me later.
"You most certainly will not,"
George's mother proclaims. I kiss him again, a kiss that's hello and goodbye and good luck and I've had a great time, all at once. I know these things are in there because I am putting them in there. Usually there are also questions in a kiss. Do you love me? Is this working? But this kiss is questionless. "Don't worry," I whisper when the kiss is done. "We'll figure out a way to be together. The weekend is coming up." I can't say anything more than that, because George's mother has grabbed his ear and has begun to pull. She looks at me again, trying to cut me down with her judgment. "Whore, whore, whore." But I don't give up any ground. A laughs at how silly it is to be dragged away by his ear. This only makes her tug harder. When they get outside, I wave. He can't see me waving, but he waves back anyway.
It's not even 3 o'clock. I check my phone and find a text from Justin asking me where I am, and then another saying he's looked everywhere. I text back and tell him I wasn't feeling well and left school early. I know he won't offer to bring me soup or check up on me unless he wants to see if I'm lying. So I turn off my phone. I disconnect. If anyone asks, I'll tell them I was sleeping. And I'll wait for A to wake me again. Chapter 21. I spend Friday morning thinking about the weekend. This is not unusual. Most people spend Friday thinking about the weekend. But most aren't trying to find a place to meet someone like A. I come up with a plan. My uncle has a hunting cabin he never uses, and right now he's in California for work. My parents have a spare key they will never in a million years know is missing. All I need is an alibi, or a few alibis. I get an email from A saying he's a girl named Sarita today, and not that far away. I'm ready to drop school entirely. It's Friday, after all. But A insists on meeting after school. I get it. There's no real reason to screw over Sarita. But maybe A is a little nicer about that than I would be. Justin's still annoyed with me.
"Feeling better, I see,"
he says when we meet at his locker before class. "Yeah, it must have been a 24-hour thing." He scoffs, and I get defensive. "Sorry I didn't text you a photo of my puke," I tell him.
"I didn't say a thing," he replies, slamming his locker.
I'm not being fair. I'm getting mad at him when I'm the liar. Then I add another lie. "I'm glad I'm better, since we're going to see my grandmother this weekend, and I wouldn't want to make her sick." As soon as I say this, I remember Justin's own grandmother, who's actually sick.
"When are you leaving?"
he asks. "Tomorrow," I say. Then I realize what I've done and add, "But I promised Rebecca I'd go over to her place tonight."
"Whatever,"
Justin mumbles. Then he walks away without saying goodbye, which is about what I deserve. The reason I've mentioned Rebecca is because that's what I'm going to tell my parents, that I'm spending the weekend with her. They like Rebecca, so they won't mind. But I realize now I will have to at least spend tonight with her, since I've told Justin that's what I'm doing. When I see her in art class, I ask her if she has plans. I pray that she doesn't.
"Nope," she tells me.
"Any ideas?"
"How about a sleepover?"
I suggest.
Rebecca looks so excited. "You're on. It's been a while since we had a Mean Girls / Heathers double feature. Or Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink."
These were our go-to movies back when we were sleepover age. It makes me happy that Rebecca remembers, since it's been a long time. Or at least it feels like a long time. That's my pre-Justin life, another lifetime ago. "I have to do a few things after school," I tell her, "with my mom. But how about I come over around 6?
"Will you bring the cookie dough?"
she asks.
"As long as you have the ice cream."
It feels so good to be talking like this that I almost forget all the lies that surround it. I almost forget all the things I'm not telling her. I meet A back at the bookstore. Today he's this somewhat pudgy Indian girl, and I feel awful for thinking that right away, for noticing that first. It's A. I am spending time with A. Focus on the driver, not the car. As we decide to go for a walk in the park, I stare hard at Sarita and imagine her as a boy. It's not that hard. If you stare at anyone's face long enough, it's easy enough to imagine them as the other gender. Then I stop myself and wonder why I'm doing this. It's not like I would stare at her and imagine her white. That would be messed up. But I still want to see her as a boy, to think of A as a boy inside.
part of the problem is words. The fact that there are separate words for he and she, him and her. I've never thought about it before, how divisive this is. Like, maybe if there was just one pronoun for all of us, we wouldn't get so caught on that difference. Part of me wants to ask A about this, to ask, are you a he or a she? But I know the answer is that A is both and neither, and it's not A's fault that our language can't deal with that. I'm sure A must notice the fact that I'm not holding Sarita's hand, the fact that there's not the same charge in the air as there was when A was in a guy's body. I want to undo this. I understand it's the wrong way to feel, but it doesn't feel like a knot I can actually untie. A explains that Sarita lives with her grandmother, and that her grandmother doesn't really pay attention, so she can be out as late as she wants, which means I'm the one with the time limit today. I tell A about this, but then I also tell A I have a plan for the weekend, and then I know a place we can go. I don't tell A what it is or where it is. I want there to be some surprise. We get to the jungle gym, and since there aren't any kids around, we allow ourselves to become kids ourselves, climbing and swinging and laughing. A asks me who I hung around with in third grade, so I tell stories about me and Rebecca, me and my crush on this boy, Peter, me and Mrs. Shedlow, the lunch supervisor who would listen patiently to any problem I wanted to share. I know I can't ask A the same question, so I ask instead for things A remembers from being younger. And A tells me about a Valentine's Day his, her, mother took him, her, to the zoo. A birthday party where he, she, saved the day by finding a dog that had gone missing. And a little league game where he, she, hit a home run because somehow the body knew when to move, even if A didn't. Small victories, A jokes. But you made it through, I say. That's the big victory. And this, A says, pulling closer, must be the reward. I know I should touch this girl's arm. I know I should draw him, her, close, and find a way to nest inside the jungle gym. But instead, I say, look, the slide, and jump over to it, beckoning A to follow. If A notices, A doesn't say anything. And even if we don't end up physically nesting in the space that's entirely ours, it still feels comfortable. It still feels like time is comfortable. I'm good. Except for one moment when I imagine Justin at home playing video games, sensing something wrong, mad about it, but having no real idea how far I've strayed. Then I think about what A would be doing if A weren't here with me, lost in someone else's life, erasing himself in order to be her. After we slide, I suggest we swing. Instead of splitting into a push and a rise, we sit down on swings that are next to each other and pump our legs to get moving in the air. At one point, we're exactly even. A reaches out her hand, and I take it. We swing like that, perfectly even, for about 20 seconds. Then we start to pull apart, the difference in our weight, or in our strength, or in the angle of our bodies. Something about our bodies, preventing us from continuing like that forever. Back in the bookstore, I make A lead me back to feed, to the book thief, to destroy all cars, and first day on Earth. I buy them all. You're so lucky, A says. Because they're good books? I ask. No, because once you have them, they'll always be there. You don't have to keep looking for them. I'm about to offer to lend them to her, but of course I can't. But enough of that, A says. Who needs worldly possessions when you can have the world instead? The voice A is using is cheery. Maybe A actually believes this. Maybe I'm wrong to want things and to want to have things. Or maybe A just gave me a glimpse of something he, she, didn't want me to see. There's not enough time to explore this. I have to get over to Rebecca's. But A and I will have tomorrow. I remind myself we'll have tomorrow. It's a hopeful farewell. It's only when I'm back in my car that I realize I could have kissed her when we said goodbye. It didn't even occur to me. That night, Rebecca can tell I'm thinking about something other than Lindsay Lohan and Tina Fey. She pauses the movie. "Is something going on with you and Justin?" she asks. "Is that where your mind is right now?" I'm immediately defensive, too defensive. "Why do you think there's something going on with me and Justin? There's nothing going on with me and Justin." With this last sentence, I realize I've accidentally told her the truth, but she doesn't pick up on it. "It's just, I mean, it's nice to have you back here. This is the first time we've done this since, well, the two of you got together. I wasn't sure we'd ever do this again." Clarity. I've hurt her. I haven't even noticed, and I've hurt her over these past months. She's not going to tell me that, but it's there. I see it now. "I'm sorry," I say, even though she hasn't asked me for it, or maybe because she hasn't asked me for it. "Things with him are fine, really. But I also want to have more than Justin, you know? Like my best friends." Best friends. It's like a gift I've been given and don't deserve. But here I am, pointing out that I still have it, that I haven't returned it for something else. "Do you want more ice cream?" Rebecca asks, picking up her bowl. "Because I want more ice cream." "Sure," I say. Not because I want any, but because I know she wants to have more and doesn't want to have more alone. As I sit there in the rec room I've known for most of my life, as I see photos of Rebecca and her family at all different ages, I realize this is one thing about us. Rebecca has to see me as more than just a body, because the body she's known has changed so much over the years. That must help a person see inside. She comes back and unpauses the movie. Our double feature takes us well past midnight for all the breaks we take for food and random things like seeing whatever happened to the guy who played Aaron and if he's still cute. He is. The only awkward moment comes when Rebecca asks me what I'm doing for the weekend. I know this is when I should recruit her to be my alibi, when I should warn her that my parents might call. But I use the grandmother excuse again. She tells me to say hello, and I promise I will. I go to sleep wondering what I'm doing, and wake up wondering what I'm doing, knowing for sure that whatever it is, I'm going to do it anyway. Chapter 22. The drive to Uncle Artie's cabin is about 2 hours, so I have plenty of time to think. I have the spare key in my pocket, as well as the bag I packed for my weekend at Rebecca's, or my weekend at my grandmother's, depending on who you ask. I'm excited to have time alone with A. I know it will only last until midnight. I hope that A will be able to come back tomorrow as well, but I know it's not a sure thing. It's funny to me that in all the time I've dated Justin, it never occurred to me to take him here. Maybe because we had his house, or maybe because it never felt like we needed this kind of getaway. Getaway. With enough time to think, I know that what I'm doing is technically cheating. I guess I knew that all along, but this is the first time I actually used that word in my head. It doesn't seem right to explain what I'm doing, but it doesn't seem entirely wrong, either. I feel I am in a messy middle ground of trying to figure it out. I know what Justin would say about that, and how he would see it. I am sure that I am doing to him something he has never done to me. I am also mad at him for not noticing, which is, I realize, completely unfair. I could text him when I got there. I could break up with him that way. But he deserves more than that. And more, he deserves an explanation. Only, there's no way to explain this. I'm falling for someone I met when he was in your body for a day. I've made sure to get there a little early to straighten the place up. I love Uncle Artie, but there's a reason his girlfriends always leave him. The cabin's basically one room with lots of stuff piled into it, including a lot of trophies from his hunts. The couple of times I came here with my parents when I was a little kid, it freaked me out to have glass-eyed animal heads staring at me from the walls, and it still freaks me out, but I've learned not to really see them anymore. There are one or two that are starting to get a little ragged, and I throw some sheets over those. The rest look on. The problem with being early is it means there's a time when the groceries I've brought are put away, the floor's been swept, and I have nothing to do. I've brought First Day on Earth with me, but I'm too distracted to really pay attention, which doesn't seem fair to the book. I light a few candles so the air will smell more like vanilla and less like Uncle Artie. But the scent also starts to give everything a dreaminess, or maybe I'm just tired. I wake up when I hear a car outside. I come alive when I hear the car door open. Nobody else knows about this place, so it has to be A. I peek out the window and see this beautiful guy, my age, him. I open the door, wait, and watch. Beautiful skin, beautiful hair, like the universe somehow knew what this day was for. "You're really cute today," I say, as he closes the door and comes closer. I expect him to have a bag, but of course he doesn't have a bag. He's only here for today.
"French-Canadian dad, Creole mom," he explains, "but I don't speak a word of French."
"Your mom isn't going to show up this time, is she?" I joke. He smiles.
"Nope."
"Good," I say, getting closer. "Then I can do this without being killed." I put everything into the kiss. All of the waiting, all of the desire, all of the today we have and the tomorrows we might not. I kiss him to tell him I'm here. I kiss him to tell him he's here. I kiss him to connect us, to meld us, to propel us. And he kisses me back with all of these things, and something else I can't identify. His arms around me, my arms around him, and both of us pulling, both of us pressing. His hands feeling me all over, giving me shape. No space between us, no space. Then I pull back a little to take off his coat, kick off my shoes. He kicks his off too, and I lead him back, my mouth barely leaving his. I push him onto the bed. I'm pinning him down. We're meeting in the middle, still fully clothed, but not feeling clothed at all. I kiss his neck, his ear. He moves his hands up my sides, kisses my lips again. There is not a single part of me that doesn't want this. I feel like I've been holding back my entire life, and now I'm letting go. Feeling under his shirt, following the trail to his chest, keeping my hand there, feeling how hot the skin is. He is moaning and doesn't even realize it. I don't know his name, and I don't need to know his name because he is A. He is A. He is A. And he is with me now. We are sharing this. Finger across my breast, finger along my back, kissing lightly, kissing deeply. Shirts off, skin on skin. The only sense I have left is feel. Lips on shoulder, hand under the back of his waistband, arm on leg, leg against leg, fast, then slow, fast, then slow.
"Hey,"
he says. Hey, I say back. I lie on my back and he hovers over me, finger along the side of my face, side of his hand along my collarbone. I respond, tracing his shoulders, reaching down the valley of his back. I kiss his neck again, his ear, the space behind his ear. There is nothing like this. In all the world, there is nothing like this.
Where are we?
He asks. It's a hunting cabin my uncle uses, I explain. Even when I gave him directions, I didn't tell him where he was going. He's in California now, so I figured it was safe to break in. He looks around.
You broke in?
Well, with the spare key. He lies back. I feel the center of his chest, the exact center. Then I move my hand to the right, heartbeat territory.
That was quite a welcome,
he says, his own hands unable to leave my body. It's not over yet, I assure him, turning his way as he immediately turns mine. Closeness. That's what this is. Sex should have closeness. Now there is closeness, not just of our bodies, of our beings. A is careful, but I am not careful. I don't want anything between us. So I take off his clothes, and I take off my own. I want all of him, and I want him to have all of me. I want our eyes open. I want this to be what it's supposed to be. Naked and kissing, naked and kneading, naked and here, moving in the inevitable direction, sometimes moving quickly, but then slowing down and taking our time, enjoying it. It is dangerous because I will do anything, but I will only do anything because I know it's not dangerous. Do you want to? I whisper. I feel him against me, the heat, the breath. I feel the momentum. I feel how right this is.
No,
he says.
Not yet. Not now.
Suddenly, I feel the colder air around me. Suddenly, I feel the world around me. I feel all the parts of it that aren't us. I tell myself he's being considerate. I look at him and say, Are you sure? I want to. If you're worried about me, don't be. I want to. I prepared. But he's pulling back too now. One hand still holds my side, but the other settles in the small space between us.
I don't think we should,
he says. I say, okay, even though it's not, because I don't understand.
It's not you,
he tells me,
and it's not that I don't want to.
Exit dream, enter nightmare. So what is it? I ask.
It feels wrong.
He says it's not me, but who else could it be? I've pushed it too far. He must think less of me. Let me worry about Justin, I say. This is you and me. It's different.
But it's not just you and me. It's also Xavier.
Xavier? He points to his own body.
Xavier.
Oh.
He's never done it before, and it just feels wrong for him to do it for the first time and not know it. I feel like I'm taking something from him if I do that. It doesn't seem right.
This seems more in line with the way the universe has treated me all my life. Send the perfect guy in the perfect body, but then make him a virgin whose first time I'll be taking away without him knowing it. There's no vocabulary in my head for dealing with this. Closeness. I got so caught up in sex that I forgot what I was really after, what I really wanted. Even if we're not going to have sex, I don't have to give up on everything else. That's what I wind up telling myself. After a spell of being only in my mind, I return back to my body and press it closer to his. Turning so we're knees against knees, arms around Bax, face to face.
"Do you think he would mind this?" I ask.
His body answers for him. I can feel the tension fall away. I can feel my welcome.
"I set an alarm," I say, "so we can sleep."
I roll over, and he presses his chest against my back, echoes his legs behind my legs, gathering into a pocket of time and refusing to leave it. Together, our bodies cool. Together, our breathing slows. Together, we feel unalone. Our bodies can fit in so many different ways. The current of sleep carries us at different wavelengths. Sometimes I wake and he's asleep. Sometimes he must be the woken one. And other times, our wakefulness coincides, and we have brief conversations as we remain holding on.
"Are you he or she?" I ask.
"Yes,"
he replies.
"I know we don't talk about it,"
he says, many minutes, maybe hours later.
"But why are you with him?"
"I don't know," I tell him. "I used to think I did, but I don't know anymore."
"Is this love?" I ask. But he's asleep. He mumbles something. It sounds like,
"Is your Uncle Artie tall?"
When we are both more awake, but still without any desire to move from the bed, I face him and ask,
"Who was your favorite?"
He puts his hand on mine.
"My favorite?"
"Your favorite body. Your favorite life."
"I was once in the body of a blind girl, when I was 11, maybe 12. I don't know if she was my favorite, but I learned more from being her for a day than I'd learn from most people over a year. It showed me how arbitrary and individual it is, the way we experience the world. Not just that the other senses were sharper, but that we find ways to navigate the world as it is presented to us. For me, it was this huge challenge, but for her, it was just life."
"Close your eyes," I whisper. I trust that he does. We feel each other's bodies as if we're in the dark. Hours later, or maybe it's minutes, the alarm goes off. The day is passing, and we let it. The light is fading, and we say nothing as it goes. This is all we want. Two bodies in a bed. Closeness. "I know you have to leave," I say. My eyes are closed. I feel him nod.
"Midnight,"
he tells me.
"I have to be back by midnight."
"But why? Why midnight?" Now I feel him shake his head.
"I can't be sure, but it's up to the body, and the body just knows."
"I'm going to stay here," I tell him.
"I'm going to come back tomorrow,"
he promises. More time. More time together.
"I would end it,"
he says.
"I would end all the changing if I could, just to stay here with you."
"But you can't end it. I know that." I don't sound mad or disappointed. I'm not mad or disappointed. It is what it is. We start to look at the clock, knowing it's time. "I'll wait for you," I tell him as he gets dressed, as he gets ready to go.
"We'll both be waiting,"
he says,
"to get back to this."
I have no idea what I am doing, and I am okay with that. He kisses me goodbye, like he is heading off to school or work, like this is the future, like we are used to this. I don't know what to do after he's gone. There's no computer up here for email, no phone reception. I pick up First Day on Earth. These are not his words, but they are words he's guided me to,
For now, that's enough. I have spent too much of the day sleeping. I read for a little while, and then spend the rest of the night dreaming.
Chapter 23. I wake up really cold, then start the furnace and suffer as it gets way too hot. I guess these are my options. I know A won't be back right away, but I also know that even if he wakes up 5 hours away, he'll find a way to be here. I just have to keep myself occupied until then. I finish reading First Day on Earth and wish I'd brought a longer book or even my homework. Artie doesn't have any books around that I can find, only back issues of magazines like Field and Stream. There's an old newspaper where the crossword hasn't been done. I try that, but I'm not very good at it. I play some games on my phone and even walk around outside for a little in the hope of getting reception. I am bored, so bored, and even worse, I can hear Justin laughing at me, telling me,
"What did you think would happen?"
"He's coming," I say.
"Yeah, right."
No, I cannot be having this conversation in my head. I look at the clock. It's after 1. He should be here by now. He's not coming. But he promised. I feel stupider and stupider as the day goes on. I'm wandering around in a t-shirt and boxers, it's so hot. Finally, I hear a car coming, driving up, stopping. All of the doubts I've been denying now turn themselves into relief. I run for the door and throw it open. I'm about to jump into A's arms when I realize the guy in front of me is very old and has a dead deer across his shoulders. I scream. He also screams, stumbling back. I scream again and retreat into the cabin.
"Who the hell are you?"
the man yells. I want to slam the door, but I can't. He's still yelling.
"You're trespassing. Jesus, you nearly gave me a heart attack. Are you alone?"
He's looking at me now, seeing a girl, seeing my legs. "I'm Artie's niece," I say. "Artie's my uncle. This is his cabin. I'm not trespassing." He looks skeptical, and I really wish he'd put the deer down. It's making me nauseous.
"You're not supposed to be here,"
the man says.
"If you even are Artie's niece."
"One second," I say. I scramble for my wallet, find my license. When I come back, he's put the deer back in his truck, thank God. "You see," I say, holding out the license. "We have the same name."
"Fine. Doesn't mean you're supposed to be here."
"You can call him," I challenge, knowing there's no way, and hoping Artie will cover for me if there is. He must have mixed things up.
"Well, you're about to get a whole lot more company. We've been hunting all morning, and Artie told us we could clean the skins here and do our business."
The vegetarian in me is horrified, but I'm stuck. "One second," I tell the man again. I close the door and change into as many pieces of clothing as I can. I pack up all my things. But I can't leave, because what if A comes? I am so mad at him for abandoning me, but I can't risk abandoning him. So I stay, as more men arrive, as they look at me funny, as they stare at me. They bring in more kills and set up an area outside to skin the animals. I reread the only book I have. I go out to the car. I try to avoid everyone, but eventually I have to use the toilet, and there's no room to move. I hold out for another 2 hours. Then I give up. It's too late. A can't be coming. I need to get home. The whole ride back, I seethe. I check my phone as soon as I get reception. I expect an email. I expect some explanation. Nothing. A's told me nothing. He could have woken up paralyzed. He might be somewhere without a computer. He might not have a car. I grasp for excuses, but I feel desperate doing it. The worst answer is that A got what he wanted, and now it's over, just like every other guy. And I am just like every other girl
who's been stupid enough to think her guy would be different. A isn't a guy, I remind myself. But really, it doesn't matter. I still feel stood up. I still feel alone. Chapter 24. I wake up early, assuming A will wake up early too, dying to explain to me what happened. I'll learn what was wrong with yesterday's body, why he couldn't make it. But there's nothing in my inbox. No word. The littler fears are giving up. The worse fears are coming closer. I try to avoid Justin, not because I've done something wrong, which I have, but because I'm afraid he'll smell it on me. Rebecca asks me how my grandmother is doing. I tell her my grandmother is fine. I keep checking my email. I keep finding it empty. I think about ditching lunch, but then I figure there have been so many questions about my behavior lately that it's probably better to go along with the day as it usually is. Luckily, Lindsay Craig threw a party on Saturday night, which is all anyone at our table can talk about. Stephanie thought she saw Steve kissing a girl from another high school, but Steve swears that was all in Stephanie's drunk eye.
"I don't know, Steve," Justin says. "That girl was pretty smokin'."
I can't tell if he's trying to wind up Steve, wind up Stephanie, or get a reaction from me. "You went to the party?" I ask stupidly.
"That okay with you?"
Justin scoffs. "Of course," I say quietly. Rebecca notices this. I can sense her noticing. I also know that if she asks me if anything is wrong, I will start to scream. So I make sure to leave the table early. I am lost in my own anger. I am angry at A, and I am angry at myself for getting into a position where A could mean enough to me to make me this angry. I go to all my classes. We're doing softball in gym. I change into my gym clothes and don't protest when I'm assigned to third base. I try to focus on the game, try to avoid embarrassing myself. I don't notice at first that there's someone waving, but then I realize he's waving at me. I don't recognize him, and that's how I know. He sees me staring at him and nods once. I wait until the play is over, then tell the teacher I have to use the ladies' room because I'm not feeling well. She doesn't argue and puts someone else on third base. This guy doesn't look at all like Xavier from the cast.